wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM, and you're streaming at kboo.fm. This is Natasha.
And Lori Mercier, your hosts today for the Old Mole Variety Hour, where each Monday morning the collective of agitator moles provide interviews, reviews, and views from an anti-colonial, anti-racist, socialist, feminist perspective. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer-producer extraordinaire.
The Old Mole burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time, the struggles of ordinary people for democratic and sustainable ways of life. The Mole goes where corporate media fear to tread, supporting grassroots challenges to top-down authority and giving voice to movements that shake the foundations of an unjust society.
Today, we continue focusing on how to understand and survive the pandemic and how organizing mutual aid, both in the short and long term, can challenge the hierarchical and inegalitarian capitalist structures that put us on a course for societal failure. We also offer some good music to hear, books to read, and films to see, always with a critical sensibility, while sheltering in place. First on the show, Bill Resnick discusses the radical potential of mutual aid in two interviews, first with Effie Baum of Pop Mob, who discusses several Portland groups who have organized to give that mutual aid, and then with Portland writer Christian Williams on the board of the Institute for Anarchist Studies about how mutual aid projects can create cooperative relations that work. Then Larry Bolden reviews Christina Baker Klein's novel, A Piece of the World, about the famous 1948 Andrew Wyeth painting, Christina's World. And Victoria Saucedo and Denise Morris review the 1954 CIA-influenced, although written by George Orwell, the animated film Animal Farm.
As always, you can subscribe to the Old Mold podcast or hear our stories by going to our page, the KBOO Radio website. You can contact us through the page or at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com.
Because of the pandemic, KBOO has had to cancel its spring membership drive, but if you can, please support the station by going to kboo.fm and donating there. Now, here is Bill Resnick with Effie Baum, followed by another interview with Christian Williams.
Effie Baum, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you so much for having me.
Effie Baum is one of the spokespeople for Pop Mob. You'll hear about them in her interviews. So, Effie, today you're the first of a two-part interview on mutual aid. The second interview will be with your comrade, Christian Williams, that shows how mutual aid as a practice challenges capitalist notions of human nature and also capital ideas and structures about the good society and the structures that make for a productive and peaceful and a sustainable society that generates human development and happiness. So, Effie, first tell us about mutual aid projects here in Portland in the pandemic, and focus on some of the exemplary projects, what they are doing, and also how they try to do, necessary and useful things, they also contribute to community organizing.
Sure. There's a lot of people doing a lot of really incredible work in Portland right now. One that I would highlight is Symbiosis PDX, which has been running a pretty impressive project out of the Social Justice Action Center, where they are handing out food 3 days a week. You can drop off food donations there. And right now they're running a big campaign to make 1,000 face masks by May Day. And so they're also organizing volunteers who are getting together in a very socially distanced warehouse space that's been donated to make masks that they are then donating to the community. The other projects that I know of, well, before I talk about ours, the other thing about Symbiosis is they've also been running a coalition call with other organizations using Zoom every week, and that is a way for organizations to kind of collaborate, talk about what they're doing, share strategies, and like review each other's work and find out about other projects that are happening. So that's happening, I think, every week. And then the project that we've been involved in has been in coalition with Rose Hip Medic Collective and the Portland Action Medics, where we have been producing and distributing hand sanitizer out of the Q Center, who have generously donated their facility for us to set up our Q Lab where we make the product. And that has been going on about a little bit over a month now, I think maybe 5 weeks. We got started pretty early on and have handed out over 10,000 bottles at this point.
Yeah, this is with Pop Mob. Let's talk about that some. But you're also, in some ways, gathering non-perishable foods, I understand, and other necessary products.
Yes, Q Center is actually also operating as a mutual aid hub where people can donate and pick up all kinds of supplies. There's food. There's also masks. We are also bottling and giving out Lysol disinfectant spray. And so there's a lot of other supplies and things that are needed that are also being given out at the Q Center.
For which community? Where is the Q Center located?
So the Q Center is located on Mississippi in North Portland. It is, I believe, I don't remember the cross street, but it's on the south side of Skidmore, because that's the way I always go. The community that we are serving with the hand sanitizer project, largely we are giving large quantities, hundreds of bottles at a time, to direct service organizations that are then distributing it in the community to vulnerable populations that would not otherwise have access to it. Specifically, a lot of organizations that serve people who live outside and are unhoused. We've also provided it for domestic violence shelters, transitional housing facilities, TriMet drivers, delivery drivers. We have recently received requests from multiple large health care organizations, which is really disheartening. We're happy to provide as much as we can, but it's unfortunate that it has come to that. We've also provided it to Meals on Wheels, to VOS, which has been who serves day laborers. And so it's been getting out into a lot of different communities, but the one thing that is consistent is that they are all communities that are unable or unlikely to be able to afford or access it on their own, especially with the way that the prices are a lot higher when you can find it at all. So even if they were able to find it, a lot of them couldn't afford it.
Effie, tell us a little bit about Pop Mob and how this program fits into community organizing projects in all of those neighborhoods, and indeed all over Portland. And then we'll have to sign off.
Sure. So this is a pretty big deviation from our normal mission. When we formed, we had a very specific and clear mission to inspire people to stand up and oppose the far right. And obviously that's not a thing we can do in this era of social distancing. And but we already had, you know, infrastructure and a group, and we're all people that like to help, and a lot of us are in other groups as well. And so we saw an opportunity to do something helpful using the resources that we have. And we had have an existing relationship with, like, the Portland Action Medics and Rose Hip, and this all originated with them. And so they came to us asking for help with boosting the fundraiser and getting word out that this was happening, letting people know that it was happening. And so we have a pretty successful social media presence, and so we were able to use that to start getting word out. Several people within Pop Mob have also been working in the lab, making and distributing the hand sanitizer and, like, running the operations. So we just saw an opportunity to do something that was desperately needed in our community, and knowing when to break your own rules is important. So this is, like, another way of doing community defense by providing something for the community that they need, and it feels a lot like it's still in line with our mission of being an everyday anti-fascist, which is finding places that you can help your own community and defend your community from a threat. In this case, the threat just happens to be a virus. So that is kind of like our biggest, I think, motivation in doing it. We believe there's, you know, strength in collective power. And so organizing mutual aid coalitions is a way to organize those structures so that hopefully after this by taking care of each other really well, maybe we can engage more people in our social struggle, and hopefully these structures will survive the pandemic and then go on to do more work.
Effie, one final thing. How can people contribute?
Yeah, we have a fundraiser on GoFundMe. You can find the link for that through our Twitter or Facebook. You can also donate directly at the rosehipmedic.org website. The other thing I would say is we have actually been struggling now to source some of the supplies that we need, specifically the alcohol that we need to make the hand sanitizer. So if anybody has some kind of connection to large-scale alcohol producers, we are running into issues sourcing that. And so that would be exceedingly helpful, any chemists out there. So we've also been reaching out to distilleries, but because of the OLCC laws, they cannot provide it to us. So we are trying to look for alternative sources for that. People can definitely help by spreading the word, sharing the GoFundMe, and donating.
Effie Baum, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Right, so long.
Deep. I was looking up to the gods when I started saying, Ave Maria.
I wanna be like
Cato, lift the Abba God now. If only you can know these holy men.
I wanna be like
Power isn't defined by your physique. Ave Maria.
I wanna be like
Christian Williams, welcome to Cable again.
Hello, Bill.
Christian Williams is an essential worker, a public servant, must be on the job, rain or shine or pandemic, because he opens and closes the bridges across the Willamette on the graveyard shift. This has lots of time to look at the galaxies and also think and ruminate about profound issues. And besides his paid work, he reads and writes, including one big seller, Our Enemies in Blue, Police and Power in America. Another, American Methods, Torture and the Logic of Domination, also a short book, Wither Anarchism, and he was on the board of the Institute for Anarchist Studies. So, Christian, right now in Portland, many groups are doing mutual aid in our area of lockdown and viral epidemics and climate change. There are so many cries for help, including the workers in our medical care and hospital systems, and also the poor and elderly. We heard about that in our last interview with Effie Baum. So, Christian, mutual aid may be our future, the only way cities can survive, a great coming together of its peoples, because the COVID crisis may well be giving us a glimpse of our future when international and also national supply chains collapse under assault from a more serious pandemic, coupled with more frequent and damaging climate disasters. Then cities and their regions, including the surrounding farms, they will wind up on their own, and they are going to survive only with a tremendous cooperative effort, a cooperative effort resembling mutual aid. And all those cooperative endeavors coordinated would produce life necessities and make sure everybody had them. Of course, other outcomes quite horrific can also be imagined. Christian Williams, tell us about mutual aid, the genesis of the concept, and its many virtues.
Well, the term mutual aid was coined by the anarchist Pierre Kropotkin at the end of the 19th century in a series of articles in the journal The 19th Century, then collected and revised into a book that appeared in 1902. Kropotkin was one of the most important figures in the history of anarchism. He was a Russian prince who did a stint in the military and deliberately got himself assigned to Siberia so that he could study the geography of the region, and then later became involved with the anarchist movement, which led him to prison and then a life of exile. Toward the end of the 19th century, he entered into a debate against what was at the time called social Darwinism, which was this theory that the people who achieve the highest status in society, it's because they in some way evolutionarily outcompete people who are at the lower ranks of society. And of course, this fed very nicely into structures of imperialism, white supremacy. And the basic assumption of that is that society is this ruthless sort of bloodstained competition between self-interested individuals trying to get ahead at one another's expense, and that that is in some way biologically programmed into us. Kropotkin looked at examples from the animal kingdom and then what, you know, at the time were called primitive societies, what we now call indigenous societies, and then the history of free cities and the guild structure of the Middle Ages, and determined that actually that whole view of human nature was profoundly wrong, and the whole view of nature was profoundly wrong, and that in fact, within species, there is an evolutionary advantage to cooperation as well as competition. And so the full title of the book is Mutual Aid, a Factor in Evolution. And he looks at the ways that animal species tend to hunt in groups, share food, warn each other of danger, and that the group dynamics that result from that sort of cooperative impulse mean that species that cooperate tend to do better than any individual in it would on its own. From this, he hypothesized a possibility for a human society that was based more on cooperation and simply looking out for each other, really more of a solidaristic model, rather than the sort of ruthless capitalist competition that people like Thomas Huxley and Herbert Spencer were trying to argue was just part of the natural order of things. There were also examples that were available in Kropotkin's own time of things like burial societies, food co-ops, you know, really, in a sense, labor unions, where individuals were pooling the resources, assisting each other, rather than behaving as sort of atomic individuals in some sort of life and death competition. And so there are these examples throughout history. And in a way, it's fair to say that mutual aid is not just an anarchist idea in the sense that an anarchist came up with it, but it's also the anarchist idea in that it is central to anarchist politics and it is the single most important intellectual contribution that anarchism has made, influencing fields like biology, psychology, sociology, and even economics. And it turns out that the research since 1902 has very much been on the side of Kropotkin and not on the side of Huxley or Spencer, that advances in evolutionary science have tended to emphasize the cooperative aspects within species and sometimes even between species. This has shown up in, been validated by social science, psychology experiments, and computer models that work on game theory have tended toward validating the mutual aid hypothesis. And even economics, which you would think would be the ideological enemy, has come around to recognizing the importance of cooperative relationships as well as competitive relationships.
Yeah, the economics was, of course, the outlier. But then for the last 40 years, until fairly recently, they were under the spell of there is no alternative to ruthless capitalism. Now they've recognized that what ruthless capitalism does is destroy societies through inequality, through the destruction of nature.
You raise an important point there, which is that there's a sense in which mutual aid is what makes society possible. It's therefore also what makes communities resilient in times of crisis or after disaster, that sort of thing. But the hierarchical society with its concentrations of power and its inequalities of wealth is very corrosive of the principle and tends to break down the solidaristic bonds which would otherwise exist. And it rewards the sort of sociopathic competition and therefore gets us in the habit of not viewing people as our neighbors and possible collaborators, but instead viewing them as competitors and enemies. And so the very structure of the society that we have tends to create the kind of behavior that it then uses to legitimize itself as the world just being this dog-eat-dog place. At the same time, it puts us on a course where, to some degree, the ability of communities to persist depends on a resistance to that overall capitalist ideology.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour on Cable Radio 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon, talking to Christian Williams, a local writer, wrote the book Our Enemies in Blue, and a shorter pamphlet book, Wither of Anarchism. Christian, many on the left have critiques of both mutual aid and anarchism as it's practiced today. I think some of the critiques are unfair. I think some of the critiques actually have some legitimacy. One of the critiques, for example, it's like opening a clinic one day a month to treat the very poor. And then the old metaphor, it's putting a bandage on a gaping wound, and that we can't let private good works and charity, as much as the people in them have good intentions, we can't let the private good works and charity substitute for public programs of like medical care and income support and having and enforcing a high minimum wage. How do you respond to that one?
Well, I think that's right, and as far as it goes, you know, again, taking the concept back to Kropotkin, the idea was never that in times of scarcity, people pool their resources and like share food, and that's enough. In addition to being the scientist who developed this observation about the need for cooperation and its importance in evolution, he was also an active revolutionary anarchist. And the idea was not simply that these sort of voluntaristic relationships within the capitalist state system were going to be sort of somehow good enough. It was that the entire social arrangement needs to be reinvented along more solidaristic lines rather than perpetuating a system in which a very few people hoard and control most of the resources of society. So yeah, it's to the degree that mutual aid substitutes for structural change, I think it's a mistake. But really what needs to happen is that the principles of mutual aid need to operate alongside of and to facilitate social struggle of other kinds. And I think that you mentioned some of the mutual aid networks that are developing in the course of this pandemic. And hopefully those relationships that people are forming now and those networks that people are creating now will outlast the pandemic and will also provide both the motive and also the structure for other kinds of organizing. So that the networks that get set up in the pandemic so that people check on their neighbors and make sure and that there are healthy people to bring supplies to the sick people or the elderly, those could also become the networks that will resist evictions, that will organize rent strikes, that will engage in community self-defense of other kinds.
Christian Williams, really good talking to you again. Keep up the good work and open and close those bridges on time and efficiently.
Thank you, Bill. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Okay. So long.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. This is Laurie Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour. We just heard music from Angelica Garcia, and before that we heard two interviews by Bill Resnick with Effie Baum and Christian Williams about organizing mutual aid networks in Portland during the pandemic that could survive as a model for cooperative relations into the future. Now, Patricia Kohlberg reads Larry Bolden's review of Christina Baker Klein's novel, A Piece of the World.
Good morning. This is Patricia Kohlberg for the Old Mole Variety Hour, reading today for Larry Bolden, who reviews the novel, A Piece of the World, by Christina Baker Klein. Once again, please imagine Larry's voice as I read. Quote, over the years, certain stories in the history of a family take hold. They're passed from generation to generation, gaining substance and meaning along the way. You have to learn to sift through them, separating fact from conjecture and likely from the implausible. Here is what I know. Sometimes the least believable stories are the true ones. End quote. Christina Baker Klein was fascinated with Andrew Wyeth's painting, Christina's World, from the time she was a little girl, and the fascination remained as she grew into the wonderful writer she is today. I share that fascination, as I'm sure many of you do. There is something austere and haunting about the painting. As Klein says in her author's notes, quote, throughout my childhood, I made up stories about this slight girl in a pale pink dress with her back to the viewer, reaching toward a weathered gray house on a bluff in the distance. End quote. In her fictionalized account of Christina, Klein tells the story of a girl who is crippled from childhood on, victim of a degenerative disease that renders her more and more unable to move much or to care for herself. While Klein is adamant that her novel is fiction, nevertheless, it is obvious that she has researched both Wyeth and Christina extensively, giving the book the feel of autobiography. The character Klein creates is austere, unsentimental, and fiercely private. Alvaro Al is Christina's brother and eventually her caretaker. He gives up his own dreams and even his hopes for a wife and family of his own to care for his sister. As a very young girl, she is cared for by her father, but he is embarrassed by her infirmity and so keeps her out of school and pretty much sheltered from the world. Quote, I want more than anything for Papa to be proud of me, but he has little reason. For one thing, I am a girl. And even worse, I know this already, though no one's ever actually said it to me, I am not beautiful. On top of that, there's my infirmity. When we're around other people, Papa is tense and irritable, afraid that I'll stumble, knock into someone, embarrass him. My lack of grace annoys him. He is always muttering about a cure. His shame makes me defiant. I don't care that I make him uncomfortable. Mother says it would be better if I weren't so willful and proud, but my pride is all I have. End quote. Christina knows that her father was drawn to her mother because of her mother's great beauty, and thus always feels judged as both awkward and ugly. Through a friend whom Christina mentored as a young girl and who comes back into her life as a young woman, she is introduced to the then young and unknown painter, Andrew Wyeth, who lives in the shadow of his already famous father, who is well known for his illustrations. Young Andrew begins to hang around the house, sketching the house and the farmland around it. He sketches Al doing his chores. He is allowed to convert an unused bedroom into a studio and becomes a kind of fixture. Quote, he doesn't see us as a project that needs fixing. He doesn't perch on a chair or linger in a doorway with the air of someone who wants to leave, who's already halfway out the door. He just settles in and observes. He understands why I'm content to spend my days sitting in the chair in the kitchen, feet up on the blue-painted stool, looking out at the sea. There's more grandeur in the bleached bones of a storm-rubbed house, he declares, than in drab tidiness. End quote. Andrew also suffered from an ailment that caused him to walk with an awkward gait, and although she refuses his request to paint her, she is comfortable in his presence and comes to see him as a friend to both her and Al. There is a lovely slow pace to this novel, and I found myself often looking at the print of the famous painting in the back of the book. What is it about the painting that makes it so magnetic and yet so sad? Although Andy hangs around the brother and sister for 30 years, Christina only allows him to paint her after many years of refusal. Again from the author's notes, quote, "For the next 30 years, Christina was Andrew Wyeth's muse and his inspiration. In each other, I believe, they came to recognize their own contradictions. Both embraced austerity, but craved beauty. Both were curious about other people and yet pathologically private. They were perversely independent and yet reliant on others to take care of their basic needs. Wyeth on his wife Betsy, and Christina on Alvaro," end quote. There is little action in this novel, and it takes some getting into, but you readers will eventually be as drawn to the novel as to the famous painting, and for much the same reason. I have been talking about Christina Baker Klein's lovely novel, A Piece of the World. This is Patricia Kullberg, reading Larry Bolden's review for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you, Patricia and Larry Bolden, for that review of Christina Baker Klein's work, A Piece of the World. Now, Victoria Saucedo and Denise Morris review the 1954 animated film Animal Farm. While there have been several film versions of George Orwell's 1945 novel, the 1954 production is notable as a British-American collaboration with funding from the CIA as part of the American Cultural Offensive during the Cold War. So, Victoria and Denise, does this CIA attempt to influence the presentation of Orwell's ideas in the film serve its intended purpose?
Good morning, Victoria.
Good morning.
We are here on a wonderfully rainy Saturday morning recording a review of the 1954 animated version of Animal Farm, which is unique in that it was a film collaboration between British filmmakers and animators and the CIA.
Terrifying.
Very. And yet provided us with an opportunity to talk a little bit about not just Animal Farm and a lot of the amazing elements of both the book and this animated film, but the intent of the CIA being to produce an anti-communist propaganda film. And we have lots of questions about whether or not that actually played out exactly the way they thought it might play out. So that gave us some interest in looking back at this film, including the craziness and escalation of use of propaganda to keep the lid on a population that is struggling with us here in the U.S. and the Trump administration. It's getting cuckoo out there.
Absolutely. So this 1954 animated version of Animal Farm, again, partially funded by the American CIA, shows what George Orwell was attempting to personify and elaborate on with his story about Animal Farm. He was discussing in the book the dangers of propaganda, the dangers of the citizenry that's not questioning, that's not remembering history. And that's very true throughout the entire book. That talks about the animals aren't remembering. They can't remember what was just said. And so with the CIA, since they are controlling the process, they delete certain important characters, animal characters, from the book into the animated version. These are important characters. And it goes to show again, they themselves, the CIA, manipulate the story. They are fashioning their own propaganda. It shows exactly what George Orwell warned of, the dangers of, when you're not paying attention. The powers that be will just rewrite the laws and rewrite history. It is absolutely revisionist history. that's happening right now.
Right, and you mentioned
Moses.
Moses is
he's the tame raven.
That's right.
He's sort of the glorified pet of Mr. Jones in the book. You see him in the animated cartoon, but he never speaks. He's never really a part of the story.
And he is always telling in the book the story of this sugar candy mountain, where once the hard work of your life is done, there is this fabulous place that you will go. Well, you'll have all your needs met.
And every day is presented as Sunday, since it's the day that Mr. Jones pauses in his work. It's the day that the animals also pause. So Sugar Candy Mountain is every day is Sunday, with all the food and all the lumps of sugar that you could eat, and plentiful hay to sleep on and plentiful hay to eat. So again, it's this fable that is told to keep the animals in line. You work hard, mm-hmm. your reward is after.
Right. This is what I grew up with, this logic around being working class and piecing your sense of self and status in the world through the work that you do, which I think is really an interesting part of how this film works, because while the influences involved in the filmmaking may have thought that they were constructing a character in Napoleon, the pig, who comes to power, Napoleon ends up being much less like a Stalin than he does like your ordinary fat cat capitalist.
Very much so.
Not to throw cats under the table.
Not to throw cats under the table, merely to throw capitalists under the table.
Capitalists under the table in the form of pigs, which then kind of throws pigs under the table too. But in fact, not all pigs in Animal Farm are bad. We see Mr. Jones, he's this horrible, wretched, dark, unshaven, and drunk. And he's out for the night drinking at the Red Lion, no less.
Notably, going to sleep without feeding any of the animals, and the next morning still has not fed the animals.
Right, so the night before, Old Major, who's the good pig, and he's the Karl Marx pig in the film and in the book, gathers all the animals around, and he gives what becomes his final speech. A call to action, but a call to self-respect, self-awareness, and to take back the fruits of the animals' labor.
Correct. And he, again, reiterates the call to comrades that ultimately the oppressor is man, and that all animals are created equal, and then promptly dies. It's quite a good speech, although it is still abbreviated very much so from the book.
All right, let's take a listen.
My dear friends, I have lived a long life. I have had much time for thought as I lay alone in my stall. I won't be with you much longer. And before I die, there's something I want to tell you. Few of us will ever know the blessings of a peaceful old age. You, boxer, when you have given the last of your great strength, what then? Whatever we produce is taken from us. Stolen from us and sold. You porkers, do you know what the future holds for you? Do we deserve such a fate? Is this farm too poor to support us all? No, comrades, when a farm is rich, but we'll never get our rightful share from Farmer Jones. Overthrow this evil tyrant, and we shall be rich and free. Comrades, revolt! But remember, when you have got rid of Jones, don't adopt his vices. We animals are brothers, large or small, clever or simple, fur or feathers, now and forever All animals are equal.
So again, that's Old Major. The old pig lived a long life and won his awards, who rallies the animals on the farm to rise up and revolt against Mr. Jones. In the context of this film having gotten a lot of money from the CIA to make a film that was an anti-communist film, I'm not sure about you, Victoria, but I probably wouldn't have included that speech.
Absolutely, you know. Because it's actually a stirring speech, but it is followed by this terrifying version of the Beasts of England. In the book, it's actually words and the animals sing the words, but in the animated version, it's this horrifying, squealy screed that, on first watching, I looked over at Denise and said, this is terrifying.
It's more terrifying, I think, than what they say. But, you know, this is an interesting piece because this is really the second point where the influence of what gets removed and what gets left out is very clear, because The Beast of England is based on the musical and lyrical styling of the Internationale, the famous socialist
famous
anthem.
Revolutionary anthem, correct. Right. And there are gorgeous versions of this song available all
Beast
over.
Of England, yeah. We want to actually play that, but I thought it's important to also say that in the animated version of this Animal Farm, 1954, we see then the animals begin to develop a cooperative society within the farm, and that this gets to the point where they start laying out their principles for how they will live. All animals are equal, no animal should kill another animal, and they begin to build the society around these certain ideals. The Snowball character, however, is a character who is also altered somewhat in the animation, and notably that character was said to have been made a little bit more rough and a little bit more selfish and controlling than actually appears in the book.
Correct. The Snowball character in the book and the animated version is a direct reference to Trotsky and his ideals. In the book, it's very clear that he is working towards the goal of uniting all the people, of making sure that all the people are free, that they're all equal. The animated version is a little bit less so. So the Napoleon character is understood to be Stalin, who from the beginning is very power hungry.
Yeah, Napoleon never seems to consider that a cooperative society might actually be a good idea. Napoleon's just like, I got to get that milk. I got to get the jam. I'm going to raise these puppies to be
my
henchmen.
My puppy henchmen.
Napoleon doesn't have anything to bring to the table.
He brings fear, which, you know, is a direct reference to the fear and the cult of personality existed around Stalin.
Well, let's take a listen to the Beasts of England and
this gorgeous version.
Yeah,
great.
This is a great version. And as we said, there's many versions of this to find out there in the world.
Beast of England, Beast of Ireland, Beast of every land and clime, hearken to my joyful tidings of the golden future time. Soon or late the day's coming, tyrant man shall be overthrown, and the fruitful fields of England shall be trod by beast alone. Ring shall vanish from our noses, and the harness from our back. Beaten spar shall rust forever, cruel whips no more shall crack. For a day we all must labor, though we die before it break. Cows and horses, geese and turkeys, all must toil for freedom's sake. Beast of England, Beast of Ireland, Beast of every land and clime, hearken well and spread my tidings of the golden future time.
This is Denise Morris with Victoria Saucedo here for the Old Mole Variety Hour this morning on KBOO Radio. We're talking about Animal Farm, 1954 animated version, and this question about whether or not the intended twisting and turning of this story for propaganda's purposes was served well.
If it was ultimately successful or not, right. Which I think in some parts, yes. As a hope for somebody who's a dedicated socialist, it's actually a major, major takedown of capitalism.
George Orwell was a dedicated socialist. He was very clear about his political beliefs. And he's making a critique of totalitarianism.
He also, remember, did this at a time when no one would critique Russia. On the heels of World War II, whenever Russia was an ally and helped defeat the Nazis, there was no one in America, there's no one in the UK that would critique who Stalin was and what he was doing, except for George Orwell.
Right, and meaning, if you had a critique like that, you weren't likely to get published.
Correct. He couldn't find a publisher for a long time. He was a man apart. The things, though, that you can read easily about George Orwell was that he was that politician's nightmare. He was, at the very end of the day, the honest man, and that was his downfall for a very long time.
What seemed to be the goal of this CIA-funded project was to link forever totalitarianism to communism. Totalitarianism didn't do communism any favors over many decades.
The goal in America is always to paint communism in the worst possible light, to paint socialists in the worst possible light, democratic socialists, as ultimately your oppressors, and if not your oppressors, your worse oppressors, ultimately than a capitalist.
That also raises this more recent concern around the Sanders campaign, because red baiting became a very handy tool for everyone, Buttigieg, Biden, the entire staff of MSNBC, CNN. This is still an extremely effective scare tactic for generations of people.
And it works every single time in America.
Again, the question around this version of Animal Farm continues to be fascinating, because they freely use some of the best examples and some of the best illustrations of cooperative living. So how on earth would any rational human being look at that and not be able to make the connection that what Napoleon was always selling, and it's made very clear in the film, Napoleon has got nothing to offer.
He never works.
Is constantly lying. This is so right now that Napoleon uses a lie against Snowball to drive Snowball out by saying Snowball is secretly aligned with Mr. Jones. And isn't that what we hear all the time?
Correct.
Trump is going to drain the swamp.
Everyone else is ultimately the traitor. Mm-hmm. That it's not Napoleon. Napoleon is only there as your beloved leader, working for you, working so hard to anticipate your needs. Mm-hmm. But he never asks what you want.
And Snowball, actually, when they're talking about building the windmill, says it's your vote. So even though they try to make Snowball look a little power hungry, Snowball is actually building a collective, using his pig knowledge to come up with strategies and ideas
he's trying to meet
people's needs. I mean, you know.
Meet animal needs.
Animal needs. Sorry, did I say people?
It's the end of Snowball, this moment in the animated version. I've come up with this plan to bring power to Animal Farm. And at that point is when Napoleon attacks him, says lies. And then he releases his henchmen, AKA the dogs, who chase Snowball away, which is direct correlation to Stalin and what he did to Trotsky, expelling Trotsky and having his henchmen follow Trotsky all the way to Mexico.
Right. Now in the animated version, Snowball exits quickly. There's no trip to Mexico.
But he's expelled from the farm. He's on the fringes and we never see him again. And we know what happens, you know, given the exchange between the henchmen, the dogs, and Napoleon.
And the viewer is shown the excess of Napoleon and his collaborators, and we see that they begin to establish more authority. They start to change the
They're changing the credo, seven commandments.
The commandments, yeah.
And so what they're also doing is really intense, because at the very beginning, they have enough food to eat. But at the point where the power dynamic changes, when Snowball's expelled, when Napoleon fully takes over, it's the moment when they say, we're going to work harder. You're going to eat less. But then in the animated version, they make it very clear that although all the animals have accepted reduced rations, the pigs have bountiful, more than enough food to eat due to their, what do they call it? Their hard mental work.
Right. Yeah. It sounds exactly like what people say about millionaires. You know, they work so hard.
They work so hard.
Know, they earned every penny.
Even though they didn't do a thing.
Right. They make the world go round, don't you know? Obviously, both of us would recommend that folks take a look back at both the book or the film. The film's available. Again, it's Animal Farm 1954 animated version. There's an original print of it. There's a Technicolor print of it, both on YouTube, and Dailymotion and Vimeo also offer it. Those are free.
And it's a reminder, I think, all these years later. George Orwell was born in 1903. He died in 1950. It's a reminder that the things that he was living with and dealing with that he saw happening worldwide happens today. Mm-hmm. So it's a call to arms. Mm-hmm. Remember, know your history. Always question it. Never believe the mythology.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Seek your own answers.
Seek your own answers. We'll wrap it up here then. Victoria Saucedo, this is Denise Morris. We've been talking this morning about Animal Farm, the animated version of Animal Farm, 1954, which was funded by the CIA.
Thanks.
Thank you, Victoria.
Stand up, all victims of oppression, for the tyrants fear your might. Don't cling so hard to your possessions, for you have nothing. Have no rights. Let racist ignorance be ended, for respect makes the empires fall. Freedom is merely privilege extended, unless enjoyed by one and all.
Thanks to Denise and Victoria for that review of the 1954 animated film Animal Farm, based on George Orwell's 1945 novel. And now we're going to check in with two Portland area school students about how they've been doing with their education during the quarantine. Michaela, what do you find, or what do you think about distance education and trying to learn from home?
Well, one of my main opinions is that teachers are very helpful. I thought they were helpful before, but it's like very recognizable. And now I realize that they're way easier it's easier when you're in class and you can raise your hand and they'll come over, rather than having to memorize all these teachers' office hours and then waiting for an email to get back to you.
So you prefer being in the classroom?
Yes.
So that's nice to hear that you miss your teachers and you miss that kind of day-to-day contact with teachers, and you're realizing now how much they help you, right?
Yes.
Anything else you miss about school?
I miss both being able to just be in the classroom or seeing friends and, just, I guess I miss school.
Okay. Natasha, do you see any positive outcomes from people staying at home?
People at home, it's better for the environment because there's not much like garbage going to the sea because people are staying at home and this and that. So also it's better for people's bodies because there's people with disorders and diseases and stuff, and it's more likely for them to get coronavirus. So, yeah.
So healthier for everybody because students are staying at home.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks you two for that that bit of news. Maybe we'll check back with you next month to see how it's going. But we're at the end of the show, and as always, you can share the recording of today's Old Mole Variety Hour or hear previous programs by going to the Old Mole page on the KBOO website, and we post there further links to even more information, including the names and links to the mutual aid organizations that people can donate to that was discussed earlier by Bill Resnick and his guests. Thanks to Patricia Kohlberg for producing today's show and to other contributors, Bill Resnick, Effie Baum, Christian Williams, Victoria Saucedo, Denise Morris, Larry Bolden, to Michaela and Natasha, and to all the KBOO staff and volunteers for their hard work in these challenging times to keep the station operating 24/7. And listeners, KBOO needs your financial and volunteer support if you can offer it. If you can share a little love, please go to kboo.fm and click on the red donate button to help support essential non-commercial community radio. The Old Mole Variety Hour will be back next Monday at 9 a.m.
Thank you.
Thank you.